Sue, in your 30s then, you had been involved in a political battle to save a nursing program, right?
Right.
And as it turned out...
It was successful.
Successful. And your nemesis was replaced.
Mm-hmm.
And how long did you stay at that school then?
I was actually there 17 years in Vermilion.
Okay.
And then I was looking at getting closer back or, you know, looking for new opportunities. I mean, it was a mixed bag because I had built a lot of credibility in South Dakota.
Right.
And so people, you know, people were trusted me.
Right.
And so I thought, well, that's a nice environment to be in. But also Vermilion was small, and I wasn't from there, and my husband and I were divorced, and I was thinking it'd be nice to get back, you know, closer to Minnesota. So.
And how old were your children? Were your children...
At the time, we were doing this political fight, they were young.
Right.
Like, Andrea was 3.
Okay.
So they were like 3, 6, and 8.
Okay.
When it started.
Right.
And then it went on for a couple of years. And then when I got the... all the monies to start the new programs, that was a lot of work.
Right.
So they were, you know, they were in grade school and in junior high.
So were you at some point then with the divorce, were you a single parent at some point?
Yep, I was a single parent for most of all of this.
Okay.
I was pretty much the main caregiver for my kids all the time. So
okay.
I was, so that was, and in fact, I consider that probably one of my, you know, the thing that I really focused on the most would be being a mother and a single parent. So I was kind of a mixed bag where I was doing both.
Right.
You know, being a single parent
and
raising them.
And so your children went to Vermilion schools?
Yep, they went to the Vermilion schools.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Do they still consider themselves South Dakotans in some way?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think they actually got a good education again because it was a university town.
Right.
And so a lot of the faculty in their schools were, you know, they were coming from education families, like maybe the wife or husband would work in the university and the other one would work in the schools. So and because it was so close to the university, I think they got a good education too.
Right.
And again, in South Dakota or in any smaller school, you get opportunities. You know, if you have a talent.
Right.
Then you don't have a lot of competition. I mean, you have some competition, but you have the opportunity to kind of explore your talents.
And, absolutely.
Yeah. Like my kids were in Allstate Choir, Honors Choir, you know, Madrigals, bands, those kind of things. And they got to, both my sons went to state in tennis. And, you know, we're tennis players. So so they got, I think they got a good education there.
It's interesting, too. Sometimes... in my experience, I don't know if it's yours, but we dismiss exceptionalism because there's big fish in a small pond.
Mm-hmm.
But quite often, I've discovered that an exceptional fish in a small pond is an exceptional fish in a big pond as well.
Exactly. I mean, South Dakota is interesting. Like Tom Brokaw came out of there, and there's in. The guy who started USA Today came, you know, Newhart, you know, he came out of there.
Right.
And so there's a lot of, you never know where your talent is going to come from or where the, you know, the successful people or what their beginnings were, I think.
When you were there for 17 years, was it within the same administrative piece? Were you an administrator of the nursing program?
I was administrator of the nursing program. I actually took that position, I think it was the fall of 84, and I left in 98. So I was actually chair then for 14 years. And I had been those other 3 years prior to that. I had been, you know, there for years, faculty, then I'd been in, you know, then I'd been doing the flying around to the Indian reservations.
Mm-hmm.
So I was probably there as 14 years.
You find that by being an administrator, you were able to keep up with the profession itself, the nursing profession itself?
Yeah, I did. I was always one, and I was a pediatric nurse practitioner this whole time.
Right.
And I had a small practice when I was in South Dakota. I would do like physicals for the Head Start.
Okay.
You know, I'd do, you know, I'd go in and do physicals for them and carried a small practice. And I always went all to all the national, you know, meetings and So I kept up with my little piece of the profession, because that's kind of expected in academia too,
right,
that you would do that. And I was a W.K. Kellogg Fellow, so I'd gotten involved with the Kellogg Foundation.
Okay.
And then I had applied to be a Kellogg Fellow. It was actually an academic community partnership fellowship, and then got accepted there. So they bought out 25% of my time for 4 years.
Oh, okay.
And so they were basically, it was more of a leadership training. Right. So I got this really nice, during that time, some of that time was spent getting, you know, leadership training from the Kellogg Foundation, which was advantageous to me.
Yeah.
Both in getting that grant we talked about.
Yeah.
Because I was, right, I had worked internally, so I knew how they did grants.
Right.
And also they had been doing training, so I kind of knew people within the organization personally. And then also, they gave me two places to learn from that they would send me to, and one was El Paso, Texas, and one was Honolulu, Hawaii.
Okay.
So over that 4 year time, I was able to go to both of those communities and talk with the leaders and learn about the culture. And,
sure.
And
now, did your kids go with you on that?
I did not take with me on my jaunts, but I did bring them with me. Like, we did a trip to Hawaii. You know, I gathered enough points that I'd take them with me on my travels. And I took them with me to D.C. because I started doing more work in Washington, D.C. when Tim Johnson got elected.
As a senator.
As a representative.
Okay.
Then I did an internship with him to learn a little bit more about that. And when I was there,
When was this?
This would have been the late 80s.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
When I was there, then Tom Daschle's office contacted them and said, send Sue over.
Okay.
And so he, at that time, was the, you know, the co-chair of the Senate. You know, he was the he was the Senate leader, majority leader,
I
guess.
He was the Mitch McConnell of
The Mitch McConnell, yep.
Yes.
And so I went over there, and I was thinking I'd be talking, you know, to some of their aides or some of the legislative aides, but it was Tom Daschle himself and Rima Cohen, who was his top health aide, and me.
So
we sat down in his nice office, and he said, Sue, I have all these people coming to me and wanting third-party reimbursement, which was that you could get paid directly from insurance companies for the care you did, and it didn't have to go through, like, a physician. And he said, I have all these professions coming to me. I have physical therapists. I have the dentists. And he said, I have nursing. He said, which one should I pick and why? He said, I'm serious about doing this. And I had been going to the meetings, our national meetings as pediatric nurse practitioner, and I knew that was our number one issue. We wanted third-party reimbursement so that we could practice a little more within our own license and not have to be always getting paid is the key issue, who's going to pay you.
Right.
And so what we actually did that afternoon was wrote up this bill that he said, we looked at family and pediatric nurse practitioners in rural areas.
Yes.
He said, this is where we'll start. He said, this is going to be difficult. There's going to be all these AMA and all these different groups are not going to want this.
Yes.
But he said, if I can carve it out so that it looks like who would not want kids and mothers in rural areas that have, you know, that need that. I think it's going to be an easier way to break the ice. And so we wrote this bill, and then he said, I'm going to keep this one. He said, I'm not going to trade this one away. He said, I'm following this to the end, and I'm going to keep it. And he did. So as it turned out, so we basically wrote the first third-party reimbursement bill for the nursing profession.
Right.
And because of his power and his willingness to support it. And when I went to conference committee, he told me people tried to yank it out. But he said he kept
it. Log rolling.
Yeah, so I feel really good about that, because that kind of opened the door. That was like opened the dike, really. And since that time, then the federal groups and then, chipping away. We're still working on it as a profession. But it really opened the door to advancing the profession and having access for people.
Right.
If you can get paid.
Easier to get paid.
Yep.
Otherwise, the problem in getting paid otherwise...
Right. You'd have to go through... You could build through a physician. So then if a physician decided they don't like what you're doing or they didn't want you doing that or they wanted to do it, they could just say, we're not paying for that anymore.
Right.
So, it seems simple, but it was kind of a big a big deal. Yeah.
There's still things to do in the nursing profession.
Oh, yeah. There's still a lot of things. And, you know, it's, I learned in working in rural areas that, you know, working as a team is really the way to go. You know, everyone has their expertise. Everyone has something to offer. There's so much to be done. You really need everybody.
So when you're talking about a team, what profession? You're talking about nursing teams?
Yeah, I'm talking about, I'm talking about like the, like the teams I flew out to the Indian reservations with.
Okay.
We'd have an obstetrician, and we'd have a pediatrician,
right.
but we'd also have a nurse practitioner and a nurse, and, you know, different people doing their roles to the best of their ability.
Right.
And it's not like you're taking, you don't really have to compete in healthcare because there's so much to be done.
Right.
But sadly, it ends up to be that way
sometimes
because people perceive...
Right.
Well, I'm supposed to be doing that. You know, the professions are protecting themselves or not, getting concerned that other people might be invading their space. Or
right. Well, you probably have, and we don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but the current Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, do you see that as an improvement over what was going on prior?
Yeah. I do. And you know, the sad thing about, the difficult thing about that act is I believe it was only meant to be a first step.
Right.
Like in actually what was politically possible.
Right.
You know, if you get involved and you get,
right.
you know, sometimes I think people that haven't been involved in politics think, oh, why don't you just do this? Why don't you just do that?
Right.
Well, maybe that is a better deal.
Right.
But you have to work with in the system you're in, and if that's not possible, get the most you can at the time, and then hopefully you build on it.
It's
and
almost incremental. I mean, it has to be there. You have to have a foundational piece and then build on it or improve it.
Yeah, and I think some of the key issues that Obamacare was able to put together were very important, but never meant to be the end.
Right.
It was just supposed to be the first step, and then now that, you know, that people have been trying to block this or block this or block this and not allow it to evolve to the next step, and that's really what needs to happen.
Right. So as we look, we're still evolving, so we'll see what happens with that whole program.
The odd thing about it, so I teach a health policy course, and I teach about one of the courses I teach, and I teach about health financing.
Yes.
And the interesting thing is if you ask the general public, do you like it that your children can stay on your policy until age 26? Yes, everyone really likes it. Do you like it that you, if you have a pre-existing condition, you can't be denied? Yes, people like that. So if you take the individual elements of Obamacare, people like them and don't want to lose them.
Yes.
But then if you ask that same person, do you like Obamacare? They'll say, well, I don't know. I'm not sure I like it.
Yeah.
You know, so they just been this big political advertising blitz of what not to like, but if you pull out the pieces, people like it. So
I think that if it's it's again, it's so reactive. Our medical care is when we need it and when we're hurting, and or when somebody is going to take it away.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise. Mm-hmm. We're not too conscious of it.
Right.
And I think people have, if nothing else, in the last couple of years, have become aware of, more so, of what they have or what they could lose politically.
And there's some big unresolved issues, and that's what's bothering people the most, and they haven't been resolved, like the cost of drugs.
Right.
The pharmaceutical companies
have
like 200 lobbyists for every, you know, they're really big in there, and it's been really hard to get that done. And the insurance companies, you know, I mean, some people say a single payer would be more efficient, and it absolutely would be, but how do you get there?
Right.
You know, and can you get there? You know, I think that's where the problems are now.
Right.
It's
the
cost. The cost is the problem now.
Right.
Is one of the main problems, is the cost.
Yeah, I don't know how you see, I see us going one of two ways. Either the whole thing is going to flip and everybody's going to have to adjust, or it's going to be incrementally done over time. It's hard for me to believe that'll be yanked out, that
Yeah.
The Republicans will be successful.
Well, it's interesting, McCain, you know, was that right. one lone vote.
Right.
And
right.
if he wouldn't have been alive, and if he wouldn't have voted. So you look at the irony of that and knowing where we could be. And they're still not out of the woods yet because right. they're looking at all the, you know, going through the judicial system to see right. what can happen.
Right. There's still is that a civil suit?
But I think it's easier for people to say what they don't like or right. be against something. Than to say, well, let's replace it with this. The Republicans don't really have anything to replace it with.
Right, right.
And never right. have, or for many years.
Right, right. And do we really want to go back and yeah. use those elements that mm-hmm. you talked about mm-hmm. Earlier? Yeah. Let's go back a little bit. Now, professionally, you're in Vermilion, but you're raising these kids. Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about your kids in school and what you were up to with the challenges that you might have faced.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big challenge to be, you know, a single parent and yeah. be involved. But so, yeah, my children were very active in high school. And so what I would do, like if they'd be in basketball and they'd be in band and they'd be in choir. Right. So then I would basically, you know, the person who had the home game, I'd get right. to that.
Okay.
And go to that. But I always set that as a priority.
Okay.
And I'm really glad I did.
Yeah.
Because those years go so quickly.
You're able to do yeah. that. Were you off during the summers? Or
I had an 11-month contract.
Okay.
I negotiated that.
Okay.
So that I could have 1 month
right.
off. And then we'd usually come up here to Minnesota, up
okay.
to the lake, and spend time with my family and be at the lake. So that's okay. always been a little, this has always been a little getaway for me, kind of a deal. And
if you were to shut your eyes and just think about South Dakota, I mean, what pops up for you in this place called South Dakota? I mean, people, you had most of your professional teeth were cut in South Dakota. But what do you think of when you think of that prairie place? Does it resemble your home? Does it resemble where you were born? Is there something special, unique about South Dakota that you found interesting, something that you didn't like about South
yeah.
Dakota?
There's both. You know, yeah. one of the things I thought of when I first moved from Minneapolis area to Vermilion, South Dakota,
yeah.
I felt like I was stepping back in time. And one of the things was the racism.
Hmm.
Like, people, like my daughter had a really good friend who was Native American, Serene Thinulk, and she would get invited to do things with the family, and other people would say to me, "You're not letting her go with that family, are you?" I mean, there, or we would be driving to Rapid City, and they'd say, "Well, you can't drive 50 because that's going through the Indian reservations, and that's not safe." And so, but there would be, and in many other ways, I was really surprised at the negative, you know, the racism that people would just
right.
on
just
our,
how
on a
normal
day-to-day.
It was.
Yes.
It was just normal.
It was a normal, yeah. yeah. And I really noticed that because I grew up here,
mm-hmm. right.
and there's Indian communities in Minnesota, but not right here.
Right.
But I didn't remember, at least in my growing up, I didn't hear that. So
right.
that was really shocking to me, actually.
Right.
Kind
right.
of a surprise.
Yeah.
One of the things I thought was really good was, you know, during this fight that we had, this political fight,
right.
I thought the women and the faculty that were women were very strong and almost had this like Western ethic of, we're just going to do this. And so they weren't like, oh, we can't do this. I mean, they didn't, it seemed like there was more of a can-do attitude
right.
in both men and women that, yeah, we can do this and we're going
right.
to do it.
Right.
So we have to do it ourselves. We have to,
right.
you know, pull ourselves up, and
right.
and that was actually a plus, I think, because
right.
the people didn't think that, no, we couldn't do it.
Right.
I think there's a beauty to South Dakota, and that beautiful. Sometimes I think of this, those, even the prairies were pretty, and of course the Black Hills is gorgeous.
Right.
If you go up there.
Right.
But then I didn't like the wind. You know, growing up in Minnesota,
yeah,
we
yeah.
have trees.
Yeah.
That would block the wind, and sometimes
yeah.
the wind would just come in. And it would come for miles and miles, and that wind would just be
relentless?
Oppressive. Yeah, relentless. It could be. Yeah.
yeah.
So there were things but I have basically fond memories
uh-huh.
of South Dakota because I had a good experience, and I learned a lot, and I think I learned things there that I may not have been able to learn.
Right.
Like the getting so involved in the American or Indian Native American community,
right.
and having Native peoples be honest with me and kind of bring me into the fold and teach me things and tell
right.
me things that I never could have learned here.
Right.
Yeah. And then also, yeah, just the opportunities. I would not have been a chair at 35
right.
or 30 years old
right.
in Minnesota. It wouldn't
right.
have happened.
Right. So things kind of, yeah who knows
yeah.
why those things happen
right.
the way they do.
Yeah.
You know, the one thing that we haven't talked a lot about, which I think is very important to you, is the church.
Yeah.
And I'd like to go back there just for a few moments and talk about your faith in and whatever you are willing to share about the importance of church and your Christianity
yeah.
in how you've tried to live your life. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could share with me a little bit. You talked about being involved in the singing and so
mm-hmm.
on, but did you find yourself being spiritually woke all of a sudden, or was it just this is just who we are and this is who I'll become? I mean, can you tell
right.
us?
Well, when I grew up,
yeah.
the church was really our social, the center of our social
okay.
life when I look back.
Okay.
Because we went to church Sunday mornings, and then once a month, we'd go Sunday night for family night.
Okay.
We'd go on Wednesdays for choir or confirmation.
Right.
We'd go on Saturdays sometimes for confirmation. And then there'd be youth league. We'd go another Sunday night. So
okay.
there would be
yeah.
weeks.
Yeah.
But we just went to church. We were there 4 times a week.
Yeah.
And that didn't seem unusual. That's just, you know, what we did.
Right.
And my father in particular was very adamant that we just went to church. That's what we did. You never,
right.
It wasn't even an option.
Right.
Like, you didn't even consider it. Like,
right.
you would never say, I guess I'm not going today.
Yeah.
It just wasn't.
Right.
It wasn't, you know, you just knew it. And I think he was that way because of some situations he had during World War II, where he just decided that that's what we would do. But so I grew up just being very embedded in the church and knowing relatives in the church and going to a private Lutheran school,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
So I can't really say that there was ever like this shining moment where I say, oh, okay, now I
take Jesus into
yeah.
my life or something.
But I don't ever remember there not being a pretty strong presence.
Right.
And I also learned the Bible quite, we were very embedded in the Bible. We'd
right.
learn about the different passages. And my brothers and my sisters, I even laugh now, because we just know, we know things about
right.
Bible verses and some of the people in the Bible and what their stories are.
Right.
That's just, we just learned it.
Right.
And I guess a lot of people don't.
Right, right.
So
if you're just a part of that,
yeah.
that's just a part of your daily
right.
life almost.
Right.
Right.
So, and it was interesting when I have always considered myself a spiritual person.
Right.
And so I would pray, and I would, if I found myself in a situation, say, well, now how can I make the best of this? So what can, you know, am I being led into this? Or
mm.
I should like to be, where do I go? What can I do to make this better for people?
Right.
So I've always
right.
kind of taken that approach to, like, blooming where you're planted or just making it, you know, doing what you can do for the betterment of others. Out of
yeah,
that.
The service end of it.
The service end.
That doesn't always go with old-timey churches
no.
necessarily.
Yeah.
Sometimes
so
it's hellfire and brimstone. I mean, in some, I don't know about the Lutheran
yeah.
churches necessarily, but.
The Lutheran church I grew up in was not that way.
Right.
I mean, there was that.
Right.
But the key elements I got out of was more the mission piece, like serving others and helping others, and if you have something, then share it. And it's interesting, I've not done this, but when I learned a lot about the Lakota in South Dakota,
uh-huh.
and some of their basic beliefs and values,
mm-hmm.
like sharing.
Right.
And, you know, if you really put that together with what I grew up in, it was very much the same.
Right.
But they lived it out in a different way, from
right.
a different, they lived it out from a different cultural perspective.
Right.
But the beliefs and value systems were very, very similar.
Right.
Which is why I think I could really relate to and want to support the Indian community, because and the love of the land and
right.
the environment and
right.
being environmentally responsible and
right.
not having to be all about you, but caring about others. That's really a big theme in both of those.
And not being threatened. I mean, also, I think it just seems to me in your life, you just, I don't know if it's confidence for sure, but you weren't threatened by the new, by the other.
Mm-hmm.
And even as you reflect on it, it was never the fact that the Lakota had their belief system right. was not a threat to your beliefs.
No, I was interested in learning about it yes. and in seeing how it did mesh more than you can imagine.
Yeah.
And feeling like if I felt like this is what I should be doing,
yes.
then it was easier to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were moments where I thought, this is difficult and this is hard, but this is what I should be doing, yeah. and I can do it, so I'll do it.
Yeah.
And so then it was easier to go forth. And I think, again, with the political piece, being young and naive was helpful. Because if you really knew what you were getting into, right. would you really step into it? I don't
right.
know. I've thought about that. I right. just thought, okay, people will find out this information,
right.
then they'll take it, and it's so obvious. So, of course,
right.
I had no idea all these other elements were
right.
really that crucial.
That the doors
and had I known
shut
it.
And open and
exactly.
Shut and,
yeah,
yeah,
exactly. But I think, but I feel like, and it's interesting, you know, the spiritual connection, I think a lot of, it's easier to push the spiritual part of a person aside or not tune into it.
Right.
But there's a lot going on in the spiritual realm,
right.
and sometimes we connect with it better than others. But
right.
But that was interesting to me. Like one time, I was in a sweat lodge. I was
yes.
invited to the sweat lodge,
right.
and that was an interesting story because I've been working with the Indian people, but Lakota for quite a while, and I knew that Gene Thinnock was an Indian healer,
okay.
and I knew he held sweats. Every week, every Wednesday, actually, in Vermilion.
And again, just for people that are here, a sweat is...
A sweat lodge is I can tell you about it. I didn't know what it was. I just knew they did it. But I thought,
right.
I'm not sure what it is. But
right.
it's actually a prayer service.
Yes.
What it is. So
right.
what they do, and this has been a long term for thousands of years.
Right.
You know, that there'll be a lodge that's set up as a sweat.
Right.
And then it'll be covered. And then they'll bring hot stones into the middle, and it'll be dark in there.
Right.
And they'll bring different, they're called the grandfather stones. And they'll bring, and there's certain things you say over them, and they'll bring stones in at certain times, and they'll get hotter and hotter, and you'll be in there, and you'll be sweating, basically. And then you'll also be, there'll be words spoken, and there'll be prayers done. And there's usually a sweat for a certain purpose. And the sweat that I went to was Jean's daughter was having some health problems. And so he wanted to do a sweat for her, to pray for her.
Mm.
And then he invited me. The interesting part of this story is I'd been wanting to do it for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that I couldn't ask, that I had to be invited.
Okay.
And I'd never been invited. And finally, one morning, this is a Wednesday morning, he came into my office. And said, I'd like to invite you for a sweat, you know,
okay.
this evening. And I had a really bad cold. I had been coughing and coughing and coughing.
Mm.
And I said, I'm so honored to be invited, but since I have this really bad cold,
right.
I hope I'm not disruptive. I don't know,
yeah.
would I be disruptive if I start coughing?
Because
it was, I had this hacky cough, you know.
Right.
He said, no, you'll be fine. You'll be fine.
Okay.
I said, okay. He said, Dawn will come, Dawn Eagle will come and tell you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what things you need to know. So then she came in,
okay.
and she said, well, I needed to wear a skirt,
right.
not pants. And she said I could not be menstruating because
right.
I'd have too much power.
Okay.
And that, and I said that. And then she just gave me a couple other ideas. And I said, no, that's okay. So I it was interesting. I went home and told my family I was going to the sweat.
Right.
And I had to wear a skirt. I couldn't wear pants. And
right.
I said a couple of things. Meanwhile, my daughter, Andrea, went to our Lutheran church that night.
Right.
And when people asked where I was, Andrea said, my mom's at a sweat lodge and she's not wearing any underwear. Because she took it to mean if I couldn't
right.
wear pants.
Right.
And of course, that's what the Lutheran church women said. Oh,
my
goodness, what's going on with Sue? That's what she told them. But anyway,
that's so funny.
So I went to this sweat. And it was a very interesting experience. It would get dark, and people would pray and say different things. And
were there half a dozen people?
I would say in this particular sweat, there was probably about 15.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was a big one. Oh. And they was male and female. Usually they're not, or in Lakota,
mm-hmm.
usually one or the other. But he had decided he was going to bring in.
Uh-huh.
And I think partly the healing, he, you know, from a nursing perspective. And it was very intriguing. And then he would sing in Lakota some mm-hmm. of the time. And then they'd open the flap and bring in more stones, and then more ceremonial things would be said. Okay. But one of the times that they opened the flaps, after we'd been in there a couple hours,
right.
I experienced timelessness.
Explain that.
It was very hard to explain. It's kind of hard to explain.
As best you can, yeah.
I looked out over the prairie, and I thought, this could be 1,000 years ago, or this could be 1,000 years in the future.
Right.
There's no time anymore.
Right.
I can't really explain it.
No.
It was an experience of like time was didn't matter.
Right.
Or there was no time.
Right.
Or so you it could have been.
You weren't in any kind of time.
I was not enmeshed in any time frame anymore.
Right.
And that was pretty unique. Memorable.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Very memorable. And then so that was quite an experience. And
you
it
think
was very
that's a feeling, excuse me, but do you think that's a feeling that people often have in this way?
I don't know.
Or it's important.
I don't know if it's part of, you know, it's definitely a spiritual thing that you're doing. You know, it's a prayerful and it's a spirit.
Well, you're connected to the past, present, and future at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. And the body's kind of like relaxed or released, and it's dark, and so your senses are kind of I don't know. It was very interesting.
Yeah.
But I would consider it. The thing I would say it is it's a prayer service. So it's like a prayer. A little different style than sitting in the Lutheran.
Oh,
but that concept is the same.
Right.
That you're praying to the Creator.
Right.
You're praying to the Creator that does all things and is in charge of all things and manages all things. Then you're wanting. You're asking for. You're giving gifts and asking for a gift from the Creator is what you're doing.
Mm. No, it's fantastic.
And it's interesting. So I know quite a bit more about the Lakota than some of them, but there's some themes in Indian feelings, but it's like, it's not just humans that are alive. You know, there's the four-leggeds and the two-leggeds and the rocks.
Right.
So these rocks are alive. I mean, everything is alive. Everything is created and everything is connected.
Are things alive or are they infused with spirits or... I mean, is it...
I'm not an expert, but I would say that they have the same status as of being alive.
Mm.
They're made... And you really, when you look at it,
we're
all made out of the same elements.
Right.
You know,
right.
We're the cells that we have are all... Right. We're all made out of the cells. So we are really all connected.
Right.
You know, we just sometimes think we're better than everything else.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but... so that was interesting to do that. So I was appreciative that I was able to experience some of those traditions and experiences, because I don't think that would have happened in another place, you know.
Possibly not. How long were you kind of affiliated with people working with the Lakota?
I would say the whole time I was there.
Awesome.
And at different levels.
Right.
And then when I wrote the Kellogg grant, then I had an advisory council of only Indian people.
Okay.
It was only Indian.
Okay.
On my advisory council. And so I would learn, I was trying to put myself in their world instead of expecting them.
Right.
You know, so it was a partnership, but I was trying to embed myself in what it would be like, you know, from a Native perspective. So I could really understand the perspective.
You ever miss that?
I do.
Yeah.
I have stayed connected. In fact, Serene Thinalk just came 2 weeks ago and with her children and stayed connected with her some degree. But I worked with, when I went to Eau Claire, I worked with the Lakota Ray, which were north of Eau Claire. And then in South Dakota, in Minnesota too, I set up the American Indian Nursing Program here to work with the tribes here and to work with the American Indian Center to try to increase the number of Indian nurses here.
Is that out of St. Cloud?
Yeah, it's out of St. Cloud, yeah. And we have different numbers of students from time to time, but I've kept that theme kind of up because I just feel like, you know, that's just something I know about and I care about.
Let's not forget,
And I care about it.
Yeah.
But I have a sad story about this to tell you. So one of the people on my, Dawn Eagle was one of the, she actually was hired to be like the head of this grant. She was like the coordinator of it. I was overseeing it, but she was the helped with it. She was working on her PhD in clinical psychology.
Mm-hmm. This is in Minnesota?
This is still in South Dakota now.
Okay.
And we've got this $1.2 million Kellogg grant, and
this
we're
is
working
about
on
when?
It.
About?
This would be maybe early 90s now.
Okay.
Yep, and she's Dakota.
Okay.
She's not Lakota. She's Dakota. She's
okay.
from Sisseton.
Okay.
And I've been working with her for a couple of years, and so we're driving out to Pine Ridge, actually to Rapid City, and we're stopped at Al's Oasis, which is a good place to get pie. I don't know if you've ever been there.
I think I've been by Al's.
Yeah.
Right.
If you want, I would stop and recommend it.
Yeah.
It's the place to stop if you're a South Dakotan.
I might go out that way. Yeah. On my way to Santa Fe.
Anyway, and we're sitting there, and she has pie.
Okay.
We were there for lunch, and she
right.
eats pie.
Right.
And I said, Dawn, you know, I've heard people say life is short, eat dessert first. But I've never seen someone do that. You know, she laughed. She said, I like this pie here. It's so good. I want to make sure I can eat it. But then we're sitting there, and we'd worked together for a while, and she said, so you're from Minnesota? And I said, yes, I am. She said, and where in Minnesota? I said, you know, central Minnesota, kind of south of Painesville, kind of, you know, kind of 75 miles northwest of Minneapolis. She said, do you know how my great-grandfather died? And I said, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Who is your great-grandfather? She says, Little Crow. I said, we have three rivers right where I grew up. I said, I grew up very close to the Middle Fork of the Crow River. So I know that. So I imagine they were named after your great-grandfather. And she said, well, do you know how he died? And I said, well, actually, I don't.
Right.
And she said, well, he was picking blueberries with his grandson, and two farmers shot him. And then they hung him up in town for 3 days and cut pieces off of his body. And I said, I was in shock.
Right.
And I said, well, I am so sorry. I didn't know.
Right.
But part of me said, that can't be right.
Right.
I thought, this can't be right. Although I trusted and believed her. So I went back and researched it, and that was right.
Right.
That's how Little Crow died.
Yes.
And I just felt horrible. Like, here, how could I grow up in an area so close to where all this happened and have no clue?
Right. Yeah, it's a part of, it's an indictment of
it's an indictment of something,
taught.
Yeah, of the educational system.
The deficits, the cultural deficits.
And it was interesting that she, and so of course then I've learned more about around here, the Dakota were banished.
Right.
And so she was, her family was banished. And but I didn't know that part of the story.
Right.
And I think that's a sadness or a problem in some of the American history we learn.
Right.
We learn a piece of the story.
Right.
But we don't really learn the whole story.
Well, in this whole region.
Yes.
Right. I mean, if we were just to study American, Native Americans over a 200-year period.
Yeah. Yeah.
And find out what did happen.
Yeah.
Where are they and why?
And where are they not and why? Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah, because early on when the Hendricksons came, the farm I grew up on, they actually came in 1868, and there were stories, there would be Indians, they would hold ceremonies like for 3 days out at the end of there was a plum orchard, and they'd hold ceremonies for 3 days in the plum orchard when the Hendricksons first were here. But now when I know what I know, I thought, well, they were banished.
Right.
And so they weren't supposed to be there.
Right.
And they could have been in trouble to be there. But they were still kind of around. And so, I mean, that was an interesting...
It's almost like the undocumented.
It is.
Yeah.
But it was their land, you know, their people.
Yes.
So, I mean, that was... So I, you know, but I think, you know, she'd worked with me long enough, but I'm sure that was troubling. You know, she's wondering, well, what, you know, this is my great-grandfather. And then I think to myself, how would I feel?
Right.
You know, sort of get to the feeling part of how it actually feels to be banished from your own place.
And all those issues today are starting to surface again with the African Americans calling for reparations.
Yes.
And well, who else, you know, is probably deserved
reparations. And I heard a woman, you know, we talk about today, she's talking about immigrants.
Right.
And she said, well, you know, we don't want these people here. And I think, but you know, unless you're Native American, we're all immigrants.
Right, absolutely.
We're just some level of immigrant, just some time frame of immigrants. And we don't remember that.
Right.
Or a lot of people don't remember that.
Nor do we remember how long it takes for
a
family to really kind of integrate itself into a community. And
And just talking about language, like my my father and mother spoke Norwegian. They that's what they spoke, and I wish I would. I learned a few words. I wish I would have learned it fluently, because I had the opportunity. But you know, when the immigrant comes, they're feeling like, I want people to embrace the new land, and so we don't want to, you know, we don't want to hold you down by your language.
And I know that we've in the last 15, 20 years, maybe not that long. Even the bilingual education. I mean, it's now known that if you speak Spanish at home, Spanish at home, and we need that child to be able to decode that, and that helps the child with the English later on, instead of just extinguishing and then have your child learn English, and you know
We haven't embraced, like in Europe they're better at embracing people speak four or five languages fluently, easily, because they haven't been afraid to, or they need to more. We're so isolated that we haven't embraced those different languages. But
well, let's get you up to where you are now. There's a lot to your story that we're not touching upon. And let me just ask you, is there something in the sweep of that history of yours that has really been a strong thread that we haven't touched upon?
I don't know. I think I always, it seems like I take on challenges.
Yes.
You know, like, it's or either I find myself in a challenging situation, or I somehow fall into it, or for some reason, because then the latest thing that I've done in my career is starting the nursing program at St. Cloud State.
Yes.
So I'm the founding director there. And that was a huge, task. It was a big job. And I was at University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire as associate dean there, and pretty happy there. But then when this position came up, my father had died in St. Cloud Hospital, and the nurses were so great to him. Yes. And I'd had a cousin that said, oh, I wish St. Cloud State had a program, because, you know, and I knew that there were nursing shortages in rural areas in particular, needed education. And I thought, well, I have learned these things now. I've had the opportunity to learn it. And then I had this place here that I loved to be at. It was, and I thought, well, when I retire, I'd probably like to retire here. And my mom was single. My dad had died, and so she needed more help. So all in all, you know, I threw my hat into the ring and got hired to do that. And that's been quite a challenge. Because starting from, there was nothing here but a piece of paper and a pencil.
Let's get some years attached to this. So when did you get into St. Cloud?
So that was about the year 2000.
Okay.
We're up to 2000.
So about 20 years ago or so. And when you begin working in St. Cloud, in what role are you?
They hired me as Director of Nursing Initiatives.
Okay.
And so they hired me.
This is without a program?
There was nothing here for nursing.
Interesting.
People had an idea that they wanted a nursing. There had been a three-year program at St. Cloud Hospital that had closed in the 80s, early 80s.
Okay.
So they'd been about 20 years without anything here.
Okay.
And CenterCare, the St. Cloud Hospital, was really a driver. They wanted more nurses, and they wanted baccalaureate-prepared nurses.
Right.
And they had, St. Ben's was a private Catholic school in the area. But, you know, not everyone can go to a private school.
Right.
Not everyone stays.
Right.
And so that was somewhat supportive, but they were really probably one of the driving forces to get the program started. Hmm. And so, so I came, but it was another big deal, because I came and there was St. Cloud State had been getting cut. You know,
in the Minnesota system at that point?
Yeah, Minnesota down. Yeah. It had been a downturn, so education was getting cut. So here I am trying to, my boss, the dean
you're
at
back.
That time.
Did you go, here we go again?
Well, the dean at that time, Dr. Musa, he was from Ghana. He was an engineer.
Okay.
And he was Muslim. And when I talked with him, he assured me that there was money, and he had the money, and it was all set up. And I hadn't been in the job too long before I said to Gordon Schrank, I said, how much administrative experience does Dr. Musa have?
Right.
Because I would be telling him things or asking him things that he didn't seem tuned into.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, he very little. He was chair of a committee. He and it ended up in this position. There had been some big thing at St. Cloud State, and I don't know, he probably had some qualifications, right. but and then I realized that in his culture, he would kind of say things you wanted to hear.
Okay.
So that, you know, I took him at face value, like, right. Yeah, this is this and this is this.
Okay.
But
yeah.
But that wasn't necessarily true for him. So I realized pretty early on that this was going to be a much bigger challenge than I realized. But then I thought, I'm here, it's my own home community.
Right.
I think if it hadn't been my home community, I would have walked.
Right.
But I kind of had a vested interest in wanting something here. And so I thought, I'm going to keep going forth here. And so, and it had an interesting thing. Gordon Schrank and a couple people, we had a good symbiotic relationship. Like, I did these two things and he did the, you know, we were just a good mesh.
Yep.
He knew the inside scoop. Right. I knew nursing and the outside scoop.
Right.
And we were just kind of, it was just kind of like a team that was, we just on a roll, mm-hmm. really. Things mm-hmm. just started happening for us. And then I set up this advisory council of all the big leaders. I went around and said, who are the most influential people in this town? And people gave me their list, and I just went up to and said, I'd like you to be on my advisory committee. And they all said yes.
Ah.
So it's like the Dan Coburns and the you know, people that had influence in the community.
Right. Right.
And I kind of learned that from the Kellogg Foundation, that you need to set up academic community partnerships, set up councils to kind of know that you're serving the community that you're in, not making up stuff that they don't want.
Right.
And then I had a nursing advisory committee, so I think I kind of pulled in what I had learned from these other experiences.
Exactly.
And I needed everything because, and then I found out there wasn't any money.
Right.
But then I went. But then I went to, and I realized that in South Dakota you'd get funding through the region system, but in Minnesota it didn't work that way. They had a different. Just because you got approved didn't mean you had the money to start it.
Okay.
You had to figure out your own money and your own approvals.
I asked earlier about the affiliations. Were this? It's different now than it used to be. It's called the University of Minnesota St. Cloud or something.
They had put all the systems together.
But so they had put them all together.
Yeah,
right?
They put
so
the
you
community.
Had to kind of swim. That's what you were saying.
They put the community college and the technical college and the 4-year colleges were all put together.
Okay.
And they called it the Minsky system.
But there wasn't a group of regents.
There was a group of regents over them.
Over them.
But if they approved you, they didn't give you the money to operate. They just say, you have the approval.
Okay.
But it didn't come with funding.
Yeah.
Which was different.
Get some funding. Now, so you had to get funding within that institution?
So what I had to do was set up the curriculum.
Right.
And that was all the curriculum process at a university is quite amazing. You know, you've got, even any course has to be, you know, a certain way.
Right.
And then you had to get state approval from the Minnesota Board of Nursing to start a new program.
Right.
And you had to give them information.
Right.
And then I had to get Minsky approval. So the Minsky system had to approve it within the system.
Right.
And then you had, then I wanted to go for national accreditation right away. Because I knew that, you know, you have to have both for the students graduating, because then they're eligible to go to federal, like Indian Health Service or prisons or anything, VA.
Right.
All of those, you have to be from an accredited program to work there.
Right.
So I thought, well, you know, usually you had to graduate students for a couple of years, but they had just changed it. So you could apply and have your first class. So we had that. So we had a lot going on.
Yeah.
But then the biggest part got to be there was no money.
Right.
But then I was
Now, this is over a couple years?
Yeah.
Or is this the first couple years that you're just kind of figuring out?
So I'm kind of doing everything in little segments, like getting the curriculum going, but then also getting, you know, because everything had to advisory group. Committee. Yeah. And I worked really hard. You know, I'd work like 7 days a week to do it, because it took that. It took that amount of work to do it.
Kids, you have an ice cream cone.
By that time,
Charlie over here.
Yeah, by that time, Eric and Brooke were in college, and actually Andrea moved with me to Eau Claire, but by that time, all the kids were, you know, she was in college.
Okay.
She was out at Stanford.
So
I was, it wasn't that I had. You're right. That was part of the reason I didn't have all, you know, I didn't have
competing. You had some time to do it, and it sounds like you had some energy, but it was a lot of work.
It was a lot of work, But then I was able to use, so I got both, at that time they still had pork barrel spending.
Okay.
And I got I had talked to Colin Peterson. He was our legislator at that time.
He's just in the news again today.
Yeah, was he?
They're trying to get him, you know.
Right. He's in a very Republican district. But he was on the 6th district then. But then they moved, they redistricted. So when I first came, and I invited him to come, and I talked with him, and he said, you know, Sue, this is the first time I've ever been on St. Cloud State campus. I said, really? I said, how come? He said, no one else has ever invited me before.
That's incredible. Yeah.
And I said, well, this is what I'm doing, and this is what I want, and if there's any monies that you're aware of. And he said, well, I hear from a lot of my rural hospital administrators how important nursing is, he said. So I'm glad to know what you've told me. And you know, he's just very congenial and nice. But then they redistricted him, and he went to the 7th district. And then Mark Kennedy was elected, the Republican, elected into the 6th. And so some of the people on my advisory board were very high-level Republican people, and they had been working, and they talked with him, and they said, and he said, well, if you did a collaborative, like, proposal to me, that would be better. So I talked to St. Ben's and I, St. Ben's, St. Cloud State, St. Cloud Technical School, and CenterCare, St. Cloud Hospital. We submitted a request for monies to Mark Kennedy.
Okay.
The bulk of it was for nursing, for USD, I mean, for St. Cloud State nursing, because we didn't have anything.
Right.
Everybody else was already established.
Right.
And in that year, in that omnibus bill, both of them put in money for us. So Colin Peterson put in about $240,000.
Okay.
And that came just only to St. Cloud State. And then Mark Kennedy put in about $1.2 million.
Okay.
And about $600,000 of it came to St. Cloud State.
Wow.
And that gave us the money to get started.
Up and go.
To get going, because otherwise, I don't know if it would have started.
Would you consider that, was that seed money, or is that actually foundational money that
it
is,
was,
is it still being renewed?
I would say it was a one-time money.
Okay.
But they were, you know, I could spend them over a number of years, set them up and spend so much. And I think had we not had those monies, it would have been very difficult to start, because you needed that infusion of monies to do it. And then of course, the way the system works is once you have students and there is some sort of, you know, there's some FDE funding. So you're, if you have a student there, you're educating, then you're generating funds.
Right.
So it helped to get past that point. Yeah. But it's never been an easy road financially at St. Cloud State. It seems like there's always, you know, there's cutbacks, or we're getting less money now, we have to cut back, and that's still the case today.
Right.
So that's always been one of the bigger challenges.
What do you think the solution would be?
Well, the solution, I think, is to improve the funding base for the public schools, for the St. Cloud State, and to have I think if you look at the data, I think Minnesota used to fund about 2/3 of the cost from the state perspective, and now it's down to about 1/3.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then it puts it more on the student also.
Right.
And then that's one reason the students' loans are going up, because it used to be a collective, let's give more money, and then students can go for less costs, and then there's more of a stability in the programs.
Right.
But now it's kind of, it's like the collective effort from the state perspective is not agreed upon, and so that's one reason I think student loans are going up so much. Because there's less money going in collectively from states.
Yeah. Well, Sue, this is your last of St. Cloud State coming up, right?
Yep, I'm retiring in December.
And as you think about retirement, you look back on nursing and the work that you've done. Is there something that you wish you would have done?
You know, I feel like, for the most part, like, I grabbed at opportunities that I saw. Like, I wanted to be a nurse practitioner, and I didn't. But then I went back and said, yep, that's what I really want, so I went for it. And that's been great to follow that, you know, to be involved in the beginning of a segment of the profession and actually have some opportunity to support its growth and be there. One of the things I've thought of at St. Cloud State, I thought, it would have been nice to have a nursing building. Wouldn't it have been nice if I could have figured out how could I was there a way that I could have generated monies to get in? But knowing the finance, I go back and forth on that, knowing how tough it is financially, that probably was a pipe dream that probably wouldn't have been possible. Or maybe it would have. That would have been nice to have our own nursing. We had a building remodeled.
Get one benefactor. Get somebody out there.
I think there might have been one. But then I ended up getting a brain tumor.
Okay.
Right after I got all this stuff done, when we were just launching it.
Right.
And I think that probably in...
How many years ago was that?
That was in 2003. Okay. Fall, yeah, so yeah, 15, yeah. 16 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I think that definitely that took time and energy from me to do that, to have that happen and to still have that. So I think that probably put me on a little more of a horizontal, you know, I probably didn't have quite as much energy to put into my profession.
Right.
I mean, I maintained it and I did well with it, but I probably maybe, who knows, if I wouldn't have had
sometimes
that.
Sometimes you might think, had I been up to full speed, who knows?
May have done more. But I'm not unhappy with my career at all.
No.
I'm very pleased about it. And I feel like I've done a lot of good things, and I feel like I have a lot of... I just think of all the nurses out there.
Yep.
And what they're doing for people. And both in South Dakota, if they'd have closed the program, there's probably thousands of nurses there now that wouldn't have been there.
Right.
And then and the Indian nurses that I've helped develop, and then also the nurses here. So I think about, I've kind of accomplished my goal of serving the community to have care.
Right, absolutely.
At least from that perspective.
No, absolutely. And I kind of wrap up here, you're a part of that group of people that are involved with the public that people maybe don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't understand that there are resources involved, but there's a lot of work that's done with minimal resources just to put things together with duct tape and twine and whatever you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
I personally, I'd just like to say, and I mean this, thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah. Sue, it's been terrific talking to you, and I hope to continue this conversation a little more informally in the future. Thanks for talking with me today.
I've enjoyed it.
It always strikes me that the most powerful people I come across, powerful in terms of the sheer sweep of their influence, have some characteristics in common, not the least being a willingness to work hard and persevere no matter what. To me, Sue's combination of these attributes, with her empathy for others and, in what became, her political nimbleness, really make her special, at least in my experience. The nursing careers and the attendant improved care and health of many on the Northern Plains today can be traced back to her efforts both at the University of South Dakota and St. Cloud State University. As Sue retires at the end of this year, one can only hope she remains a source of wisdom and information for those who carry on the nursing work and the nursing education that she has been a part of over the last four decades. Thanks again for listening in. This is John Lund, and this has been another episode of Thinking It Through.